This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
On the program today, we've got some debt, some jobs, some climate, and a really, really expensive violin. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Wednesday, March 1st. Good to have you with us. It's been close to a year now since the Fed started nudging up interest rates to try to slow down inflation. The idea is by making borrowing more expensive for people and businesses, demand falls and prices stabilize. So it's maybe a little surprising to learn from the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation this week that banks have not seen borrowing slow down overall. The FDIC's quarterly survey of banks found that total loan balances rose from the previous quarter and over the previous year. Marketplace's Justin Ho explains.
The FDIC found that loan balances increased across the board. Consumer loans, commercial and industrial loans, even mortgages. Peter Alden, the CEO of Bay State Savings Bank in Massachusetts.
It's a little surprising. We thought we'd come through year end and into the first quarter with loan demand based on the higher interest rates decreasing.
But Alden says inflation is pushing business clients to borrow so they can pay more for inventory. Consumers are using home equity loans to pay off their credit card debt.
They can move from, you know, a credit card rate of, say, over 10 or 11% down to a 6.5% interest rate on a equity loan.
Businesses can justify paying higher interest rates if the projects they borrow for pay off. David Reiling, CEO of Sunrise Banks in Minnesota, says a lot of commercial real estate developers have been borrowing more lately.
They feel that they can raise rents and stay competitive, and so the math still works.
The FDIC says loan making could slow down if the global economy stumbles. But Dominic Miartin, CEO of Optus Bank in South Carolina, says the economy in his region is booming.
Everything from real estate to restaurants to new businesses, the interest rates have not seemed to damper that appetite for growth and access to credit at all.
Miartin says borrowers are asking about interest rates. Many are trying to get creative.
Where you may have a 3 or 5 year fixed rate loan at, let's say, 6.5% or even 7%, but then you make it 5 years from now, you make it adjustable.
The idea is to save some money if interest rates fall in the long run. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, markets were mixed. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Looking ahead to next week, that's when we'll get the latest tally of job openings for the month of January, and a few days later, the employment report for February. Economists will be looking for signs of any weakening in the job market, which has stayed persistently strong in spite of the Fed's aforementioned efforts to slow the economy. But how much does the job market, and therefore the people who need the work, have to suffer? How much does wage growth need to slow in order to get to normal levels of inflation? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has that one.
We all want to raise, all of us. So what's wrong with that? Sarah House is senior economist at Wells Fargo.
If you have wages growing at a rapid pace and businesses are either going to have to raise prices or they're going to go out of business.
Okay, so then what is the level of wage growth that doesn't drive a business under or fuel even more inflation? Because right now, we're at about 4.5% wage growth year over year.
3.5%.
Mark Zandi is chief economist at Moody's Analytics. So why 3.5%? Where does that number come from?
Well, wage growth is equal to the rate of inflation plus the productivity growth of the workforce.
Basically, that means, yeah, wages go up with inflation, but they also go up with workers and businesses getting more productive. Economists add a number for productivity growth to a not insane level of inflation, and they get 3.5%. The problem is that's below where we are now. So if wage growth has to slow down, does that mean the labor market needs to suffer? Does unemployment need to rise?
We don't know the answer to that.
Lawrence Summers is professor of economics at Harvard and former head of the National Economic Council under President Obama.
Demand needs to fall relative to supply if we're going to bring down inflation. And historically, when that's happened, there's often been a side effect of rising unemployment.
Mark Zandi says maybe the labor market won't need to go down in flames because wage pressure is already easing as our inflation expectations fall.
In part because gas prices are down, you know, they're moving in the right direction. We're starting to see a moderation in rent growth and, you know, food prices seem to be headed in the right direction as well.
So maybe workers won't ask as much for raises or get as far when they do. But you should still try. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
It's been 5 months since Hurricane Ian slammed into southwest Florida, ultimately killing more than 150 people and causing nearly $113 billion in damage. I first met Nina Migliaccio in early October at an emergency shelter in Venice, Florida, about a week after the hurricane. She had escaped her flooded and wind-battered house with her husband Carl and their Chihuahua Candy. And she was still shaken, thinking back on the night of the storm.
Oh, my God. I have chills.
Nina recalled the sound of the wind pounding against her living room window as she and Carl, both in their 70s, tried to brace it with their bodies.
Like, pop, 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 pop. So we try hold, because I think if this broke, we finish.
That window eventually did break, along with two others. Their garage door was damaged. Parts of the roof were torn off. When we talked, Nina didn't know when they'd be able to go home.
Because we cannot go back. You must have roof.
I was thinking about Nina because this week, the First Street Foundation, a nonprofit climate research group, warned that in the coming years, more people and properties will face damaging winds because of climate change. I called Nina the other day to see how she's doing now.
It's a slow process, very slow process.
5 months later, she's still waiting for workers to finish her new roof. Two broken windows have yet to be replaced, and she's fighting with her insurance company to get reimbursed for a new garage door.
If I have pocket money, I'd be doing so easy, but we don't have pocket money. Like, you know, we have living money, like more senior.
The First Street Foundation's models show that in the next 30 years, more than 13 million properties that aren't currently exposed to tropical cyclones will be at risk. Founder and CEO Matthew Eby says that's for two main reasons. Number one,
overall, hurricanes are becoming much more intense.
Warmer sea surface temperatures lead to higher wind speeds. And Eby says tropical cyclones will be more likely to become major hurricanes. Reason number two?
Hurricanes are actually latitudinally moving further up north.
Eby says that means places like Brooklyn, New York, and Newport News, Virginia, will see big increases in maximum wind speeds and wind damage. Florida remains the riskiest state, but Eby says hurricane danger will increase in northern cities like Jacksonville, while actually declining a bit in South Florida.
What you're seeing across the state overall is an increase from $13 billion to $14 billion in average annualized losses, even though things are going down in certain areas.
On the group's website, riskfactor.com, you can type in any address and check out your risk of flooding, wildfire, extreme heat, and now wind, and how much damage it might cause based on things like the type and age of your roof and your local building codes.
The main thing we want people to do is know that there's something you can do about this. You can buy the appropriate insurance coverage or do the appropriate resilience measures to harden your home.
The question is whether putting this information in people's hands will change where they live. Daryl Fairweather is chief economist at Redfin, which has incorporated flood data from Risk Factor in its real estate listings for a few years. Last fall, the company published research showing that flood information did have some effect on behavior.
People who were previously viewing extremely risky homes for flooding ended up buying homes with about half the risk that they originally were looking at.
Over time, she says information about climate risks will affect property values. Others are skeptical, though, pointing to research showing an increase in people moving to western cities facing drought and wildfire and to hurricane-prone Florida. Robert Hartwig is a professor of risk management and insurance at the University of South Carolina.
Even this avalanche of information is apparently having no effect whatsoever at slowing down building or migration within the United States to the most vulnerable areas of the country.
Hartwig says there are just too many incentives that keep people living in harm's way, like heavily subsidized insurance and government relief when disaster strikes. You can hear a lot more about that on our podcast, How We Survive. Season 2 is available on the platform of your choice. Coming up.
Having 3 months out of 12 months paid for your rent was awesome.
I'll say. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 5 points, not even a tenth of a percent, to finish at 32,661. The NASDAQ shed 76 points, 2/3%, to close at 11,379. And the S&P 500 dropped 18 points, just short of 0.5%, to end at 3,951. Drug maker Eli Lilly and Company cut the prices of its insulin products by 70%. It also capped out-of-pocket costs for seniors at $35 a month. President Biden praised the move. Shares in Eli Lilly added 0.9%. Looks like Caterpillar and its union workforce may avoid a strike. The company reportedly struck a tentative deal with the union representing workers at 4 facilities. The workers had threatened to strike over wages, safety measures, and health care benefits. Shares in Caterpillar gained 3.8%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. Sport utility vehicles released nearly 1 billion tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere last year. That's according to a new report from the International Energy Agency. And it means the global SUV fleet is now a bigger greenhouse gas emitter than many countries, including the UK and Germany. While car sales overall dropped last year, sales of SUVs actually grew. They're now almost half of the global auto market. Marketplace's Matt Levin looked into what's driving the appeal.
Americans' love affair with big cars is well documented, but SUVs now account for nearly 50% of the European market. Europe, home of the Mini Cooper and $7 per gallon petrol. You can thank the crossover.
They look great. They give you the advantages of a typical SUV with some of the traditional advantages and maneuverability of a sedan.
Doug Mell is an auto industry analyst for the consulting firm Kearney. For the unfamiliar, crossovers are basically smaller SUVs. Think your Toyota RAV4 or Hyundai Tucson. Mel says they typically have pretty decent gas mileage, even compared to regular sedans. And that's if they use gas at all.
Crossovers and SUV are about 55% of new electric vehicles sold.
Here in the U.S., past stigma around SUVs as gas-guzzling totems of machismo have given way to something more family-friendly. Michelle Krebs is an analyst with Cox Automotive.
I think if you go to any elementary school parking lot, that you would see them today filled with mostly sport utility vehicles versus minivans.
Crossovers and traditional SUVs are still loathed by pedestrian safety advocates who argue there's just no need for dangerously big cars. But Thomas Hundle at the car news site The Autopian says that really isn't impacting sales, although he thinks crossovers may not have the same appeal for Gen Z buyers.
You had people who wouldn't be caught dead in a station wagon or in a minivan. You'll soon have young adults who would not be caught dead in crossovers.
He says no one wants to drive the same car their parents drove. Well, until they also have kids. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
In a couple of weeks, a rare 300-year-old violin is going up for auction. Just how rare? It's expected to fetch $10 million, or maybe even more. So why in the world would a violin cost so much, you might ask? A certain Marketplace reporter went in search of the answer to that question, and in the process got a chance to play the instrument. From New York, here's Marketplace violinist Nova Safo.
The old joke goes, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? Practice, practice, practice. Well, just a couple of blocks down from Carnegie Hall is Teresio, an auction house for rare stringed instruments. It's in an unmarked high-rise next to a Crunch gym and a Subway sandwich shop. And many of the highly practiced violinists who play at Carnegie Hall often stop by Teresio to check out the latest treasures.
Yeah, the color is remarkable.
It's beautiful.
And boy, does Teresio have a doozy of one right now.
It makes me nervous holding it.
That's Carlos Tomei, Teresio's lead expert on historic violins.
I get emotional when I hold history like this.
What Tomei is holding is a nearly 300-year-old violin made in Cremona, Italy by Giuseppe Guarneri del Gesù. He's one of the two people considered the greatest violin makers in history. You may have heard of the other one, Antonio Stradivari.
The difference between both of them is that Stradivari has made 600 known to us now instruments, and there are only 150 of Del Gesù.
In other words, the violin in his hand is one of very few in the world, and it makes a beautiful sound, much better than, say, the amateur clunker that yours truly plays at home.
So this is the Guarneri Del Gesù, and for some reason, I'm allowed to touch it and play it. My goodness. It's like going from a Camry to a Lamborghini.
The gentleman laughing is professional violinist Charles Yang, who just won two Grammys. And Teresio asked him to stop by to demonstrate what the violin can really do.
Wow! I mean, I wish my bank account could buy this. I would do it right now.
Not that Yang's violin is a slouch. It's worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. Even the first pro violin his parents got him when he was just in high school was very expensive.
And they had to remortgage the house for it. And it wasn't anything like this, but those violins too, that violin stayed with me for years and years, you know, and I still play it today.
So, considering the demand from all of those talented violinists out there and how much they're willing to shell out for a great-sounding instrument, why not just replicate a Guarneri, reverse-engineer it, and make thousands and thousands of copies for everyone who wants one?
We know exactly how they were made because a lot of these tools and materials have survived over the years.
That's David Bonzi, a violin maker and restorer of old instruments. He has a separate shop not far away from Teresio. Bonzi says that modern-day violin makers know all the basics of how Guarneri and Stradivarius violins were made, but the devil is in the details.
What we don't know is what was inside their heads. When they made these instruments, they had no benefit of science. They were only going on their intuition and what was traditionally done, what was taught to them.
And despite CT scans, chemical analysis, multiple scientific studies, violin makers today can't definitively replicate the secret sauce of the great masters to replicate how their creations sound. In the meantime, we're stuck with a limited supply of the old greats. And Tarisio's Carlos Tomei says demand keeps growing.
We've seen how they've become an alternative asset for many people. So the prices are going fast and going high. They're appreciating a lot.
In fact, if the violin coming up for auction fetches $10 million, it won't even set a record. Tarisio sold another for $16 million more than a decade ago. Pro violinists like Charles Yang are priced out, and they must wait to see if a wealthy benefactor will buy a Guarneri or a Stradivarius and lend it to them, something that does happen frequently. In the meantime, Yang is happy to play the Guarneri that's up for auction any chance he gets.
What do you think? Do you think you could play the Marketplace theme song?
How does it go? Something like that.
That's wonderful. In New York, I'm Nova Safo for Marketplace.
Fewer people are moving these days as interest rates have gone up and pandemic effects have waned. Looking at U.S. Postal Service data from last year, the National Association of Realtors found that nearly 70% of zip codes had fewer inbound movers in 2022 compared to the year before. Another reason might be that moving is expensive, but sometimes it can save you money in the long haul. Here's the next installment of our series, Adventures in Housing.
My name's Erica Jamel. I live in DeBary, Florida, and I'm a home and business organizer, but currently most of my time I'm a full-time mom right now. There was a time in my life where I was moving around every single year for 7 years straight. From the time my son was born, I was in the process of wanting to buy a house eventually, but every time the year was up in the apartment, the rent would go up a few hundred. And I was like, oh, okay, I had a decision. Do I stay or do I find a cheaper place? Well, I would see an advertisement or something saying, you know, $200 off your rent for 12 months. So I'm like, okay, wow. It's originally $900. Go to $700. Okay, that's doable for 12 months. That gives you time to figure things out. So I would see those kind of deals, or they even had specials where if you referred someone to move in there, your rent would be paid for the month. So I got three different people. Some of my coworkers were looking for a place. They'd always talk about like, oh, I need this weekend off because I got to find a place. So I'd be like, hey, I know a place you can move into. Having 3 months out of 12 months paid for your rent was awesome. Moving around so much, yeah, you develop a system for sure because you know it's going to be temporary and you're like, all right, I got a year. What do I need for the year? First, you get the boxes and then you put them in areas so then it's easy to pack and label. Definitely need a label. Every apartment, I swear, I left more and more packed. While I was saving up for a house, I didn't have a vehicle, so my son and I pretty much lived at the bus stop. We'd walk a lot. Well, he was in the stroller. I'd push him. But we'd go everywhere. I tried to move into a place that was like in the middle of everything, so it was easy to get to the laundromat, the grocery store, work. But that was while I knew the bigger plan was save up for a house. the first house that I bought, just the backyard, the porch, it just felt at home. I was able to unpack everything and not leave anything packed up. It was worth everything happened, you know, prior to all that. I'm just happy that I am a homeowner now because I can rest.
That was Erica Jamil in Debary, Florida. If you've got a housing adventure you want to share, good or bad, you can tell us about it at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, the National Park Service has announced its prediction for peak bloom of the famous cherry blossoms in our nation's capital, March 22nd through 25th. We haven't had much of a winter out here in the Mid-Atlantic, so the Yoshino cherry trees surrounding the tidal basin never reached winter dormancy. Officials say that makes predicting peak bloom more challenging. The EPA tracks the annual peak going back to 1921. The average over that century is April 4th. And yes, it's been getting earlier thanks to global warming. The EPA says peak bloom has happened before April 4th in 16 of the past 20 years. The annual Cherry Blossom Festival in D.C. typically brings swarms of visitors and millions of dollars in tax revenue for the city. Okay, here's your moment of economic context. Mortgage interest rates have been moving higher again, up half a percentage point in the past month to 6.7% for a 30-year. And as rates have gone up, demand for home loans has fallen. The Mortgage Bankers Association said today applications for home purchases fell last week to a 28-year low. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Amy Scott. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.